This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, dedicated to increasing knowledge and engagement in the world's most critical issues. On April 24th, the Council is hosting a conversation with New York Times White House and National Security Correspondent David Sanger to discuss his latest book, New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. Registration for this event is available at globalaffairs.org/events.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is WBEZ's Weekly News Recap. Each week, we catch you up on the biggest local and state stories that you might have missed. Stories like these.
Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin went live with a website announcing his campaign for governor. This highly anticipated announcement shakes up the GOP primary.
The city's inspector general just released its scathing findings about how the city handled the aftermath of the wrong police raid on Antoinette Young's home. It details the extent of misconduct carried out by multiple city agencies, including the mayor's office, police department, and civilian office of police accountability.
The Illinois Supreme Court heard arguments today over the controversial use of campaign money to fight corruption cases.
With us for those stories and more, Rick Pearson, chief political reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and Aaron Hegarty, city hall reporter for the Daily Line. We'll hear from Aaron in a moment, but Rick, we're going to start with a state elections update from you. We had a new Republican challenger enter the governor's race. What do you know about Richard Irvin?
I'd like to tell you about him, but, you know, like most Illinoisans, we're still trying to figure out exactly who he is. Irvin, 51, is the first black mayor of Aurora, the state's second largest city, recently reelected to that post. He becomes the fifth Republican to announce for the GOP nomination in the June 28th primary. But he is somewhat distinct from the others in that he's part of what has been a recruiting process by allies of Illinois' wealthiest person, Ken Griffin, the founder and CEO of the Citadel investment firm. And Griffin has vowed to go all in on an effort to defeat first-term Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. So Irvin becomes the head of a slate that was created with designs of appealing to Griffin as well as Griffin's finances in order to have a wealthy challenger in the general election against Pritzker, who's a billionaire entrepreneur and heir of the Hyatt Hotel fortune.
But Irvin's gotten some criticism for not being a true Republican. What's that about?
Yeah, and that's kind of where the early demarcation is coming from, is that Irvin had pulled Democratic ballots in four of the most five primary elections. And he's facing criticism about, you know, how Republican are you? In his debut video announcement, three-minute video, very slickly produced, grandson of a slave, he was very much touting his law and order credentials as a former assistant state's attorney in Cook and King County, how he was for All Lives Matter and against defund the police. All of these kinds of things that are playing into a Republican playbook here in Illinois, but nationally. But even as he talked about All Lives Matter in the run-up for his reelection, he told a local outlet that he believed in the Black Lives Matter movement very passionately. So what we're seeing here in this early stage is, you know, people trying to define Irvin, who has also said some very nice things about Governor Pritzker and Pritzker's handling of the coronavirus. We're seeing those kinds of things come out while Irvin himself has not had a media availability, has not discussed, you know, what he thinks of Donald Trump, does he believe the big lie, those kinds of things. And this, the longer that that takes place, there was more of an opportunity for opponents to define him rather than what he really needs to do is define himself.
Well, you mentioned the governor, J.B. Pritzker, deposited $90 million into his campaign coffers this week. The governor now has more money in his campaign war chest than all the Republican candidates combined. Is that right?
Right. And the thing is, with Pritzker, you have to remember that when he first ran 4 years ago, he put in $171.5 million of his own money. So money is not really an issue when it comes to the incumbent governor. In fact, the $90 million was put in just days before Irvin announces as kind of making a statement that, you know, I'm ready to go toe-to-toe with Ken Griffin and his money. And Griffin and has basically had kind of a proxy war with Republicans against Pritzker. Griffin gave a lot of money to Bruce Rauner, who Pritzker defeated 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. He also gave money, lots of money, to defeat Pritzker's signature effort to try to switch the state from a flat rate income tax to a graduated tax system that was defeated on the ballot. So everybody's waiting to see Griffin get in the game here. He said he's encouraged by Irvin's entry into the race. But as far as the other four candidates that have been previously announced, only one, Jesse Sullivan, who's a very much an unknown, who lives in central Illinois, friends with the cyber currency community. Mm-hmm. He's got about $10 million in the bank. But again, here's somebody else that no one knows who he is or what he stands for. There's questions about his Republican bona fides. And then you've got Gary Rabine, a Northwest suburban businessman from Bull Valley, who is very much into the Trump network. He hosted a fundraiser for Trump at the Bull Valley Country Club that he partially owns and had Don Jr. and his girlfriend attend that. He's part of a member of the board of Turning Point USA, which mm-hmm. is very much into promoting the big lie. And then you've got downstate Darren Bailey, who is a state senator, part of also very much of the extreme kind of rural right, where downstate finds most of its voters leaning Republican. And Bailey has been a anti-maxer, anti-vaccinate guy who supported efforts really to decouple Chicago from the rest of the state.
Yes, the June 28th primary will certainly be one to watch. Aaron, let's turn to City Hall now. Lori Lightfoot, she was back at work in person this week after being diagnosed with COVID, traveling to Washington for the annual Conference of Mayors. Now, the CDC recommends that people who test positive for COVID-19 avoid travel for 10 full days after experiencing symptoms. She didn't wait that long, did she?
No, she didn't. I think back to less than 2 weeks ago, Tuesday, January 11th, the mayor issued a statement saying she had, you know, tested positive for COVID that morning and had cold-like symptoms, and she'd be working from home. And she did that, but this past Tuesday, 1 week later, she said she'd be traveling, like you said, to D.C. to confer with a bunch of other mayors from across the country on a variety of topics. She said she, you know, talked to the Chicago Health Commissioner, Allison Arwady, and got her clearance. So as you noted, the CDC's website still says people who have tested positive should, you know, avoid travel for a full 10 days after the positive test or after, you know, symptoms have kind of begun. It does note that if people have to travel between 6 and 10 days after testing positive, they should wear a mask mm-hmm. around others, which, you know, I wasn't in D.C. I've been here in Chicago, but it does look like the mayor has been wearing a mask in all the photos that I've seen.
Okay. So the mayor was also hearing a lot of criticism over the past week after the Chicago Inspector General's report into the Anjanette Young case was released. What did that report say, Aaron?
Yeah, so this was a summary of a report from the city's Inspector General. And it found that officials from, you know, multiple different city departments, including Mayor Lightfoot's own communications department, didn't tell the truth and misled the public about details in the aftermath of CPD's wrongful raid of Anjanette Young's home in 2019. So that's when they wrongfully entered her home and carried out a search warrant on the wrong home of Young while she stood handcuffed and without clothes on, and she, you know, repeatedly told officers they had the wrong house. So this this report, which was published last Friday, found that city officials delayed their response to the wrong raid. They didn't, you know, appropriately respond to Young as a victim a wrong raid, and they, you know, they didn't act with transparency, and they misled and lied to the public and journalists. They basically put public relations over the city's mission to, I guess, you know, serve its residents. And in addition to that, city employees, you know, were charged with, and no one was named in this report. This is all just referring to people by their positions, but okay. It charged that, you know, city employees acted without regard for the city's Civilian Office of Police Accountability, which is supposed to operate with, you know, independence in investigating misconduct cases. So it didn't look good.
Cook County's top judge refused Lori Lightfoot's request to keep more people jailed while awaiting trial. Let's listen to what the mayor had to say.
I'm going to keep fighting because I believe that having 2,300 violent offenders out on the streets makes our communities less safe. These judges are operating seemingly without any regard for public safety, and not taking that into consideration as they are mandated to do by state law is a huge problem, and I'm going to keep pressing that point.
Aaron, briefly tell us, why is the mayor being blocked?
I mean, this isn't something that I've been covering closely, but I do think it's notable that Chief Judge Timothy Evans basically says that the data that Mayor Lightfoot is citing is not correct. And, you know, she's trying to make the argument that defendants being released on electronic monitoring are driving up crime in the city. But when Evans denied Lightfoot's request to keep those defendants in jail, you know, he said her data is flawed and the data doesn't actually show that people out on electronic monitoring are driving up the violence that Lightfoot says that they are.
Another quick City Hall story here for you, Aaron. The mayor received a letter that was signed by some 50 civil rights attorneys. They're urging her to drop an ordinance that allows the city to fine gang members and seize their property. Just briefly tell us about this ordinance and what the attorneys are saying.
Yeah, so the attorneys are basically saying that they want her to drop this proposal, saying that it would kind of open the door for more expensive litigation for the city and would, quote, perpetuate racial disparities in law enforcement practices. And they say that Lightfoot's proposal to sue gang members wouldn't actually reduce violence or harm, which is kind of the mayor's whole, you know, rationale for introducing this ordinance. Now, the mayor yesterday said that she doesn't see her proposal, you know, leading to more costly misconduct litigations for the city. But aldermen are scheduled to discuss this ordinance publicly for the first time this afternoon in a committee hearing. You know, they're not scheduled to vote on it. It's just going to be a discussion. And it's worth noting that it's also gotten pushback from Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell, the ACLU of Illinois, and, you know, a bunch of faith-based organizations. So, I'm really interested to see how this proposal is presented today in this city council committee, because we, as of, you know, this morning, I hadn't seen a revised copy of Mayor Lightfoot's proposal that's going to be discussed today. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing arguments for and against.
Rick, the Illinois Supreme Court is looking into the practice of politicians using campaign funds to pay criminal defense lawyers. Illinois does have a reputation for its political corruption. So how common is it for indicted politicians to use campaign funds for this purpose?
Oh, it's very common. It's been a long-standing practice. And what is kind of curious about the Supreme Court taking this case up is the fact that even lawyers for the State Board of Elections say that, you know, absent a state law to prohibit the practice, there's no way to stop that from being done. I mean, the argument obviously being is that, you know, people, candidates raise money, politicians raise money to help them get elected to public office to do the public's duty, and that when there are instances of improprieties alleged or truthful, that they get to use those very same resources as part of their defense fund. And, you know, we're seeing in the high-profile cases like Mike Madigan, the former House Speaker, and with Ed Burke, who have stockpiled millions of dollars in their campaign funds, that a large number of bucks are going to law firms as part of defense operations over alleged misconduct. So
yeah.
I think it'll be curious to see if the Supreme Court will actually say that the practice can end absent the possibility of the legislature itself enacting a ban on it on its own.
That's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune and Aaron Hegarty from the Daily Line. And don't go away. There's plenty more where that came from, including stories like these.
Three Illinois men arrested today for storming the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th insurrection more than a year ago.
Currently in isolation at an undisclosed out-of-state prison, Jason Van Dyke is less than 3 weeks from freedom. Van Dyke was convicted of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery. One count for each shot that took the life of Laquan McDonald.
Two Illinois-based COVID testing labs are now being sued by the Minnesota Attorney General.
Yeah, they're being accused of faking their test results.
Mayor Lightfoot back on the job, back in public, after COVID-19 sidelined her last week.
So back to you, Rick. Three more Illinois men, two brothers and a cousin, were indicted this week in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. They're among 23 Illinoisans charged so far in the attack. What do we know about these guys?
Well, the brothers live, one lives in Lockport, one lives down in Metro East area down by St. Louis and Glen Carbon, as well as the third man. They were basically tracked because of their mobile devices, and that's how the FBI has actually been working very diligently in this investigation that now there's been over 725 people arrested in what they call the largest criminal investigation and prosecution in U.S. history. And it's the combination of being able to track their phones as well as their use of their cell phones while they were inside the Capitol grounds. I mean, all three of these men have admitted that they were inside the Capitol, according to what the FBI says.
Mm-hmm.
And they have images of them inside the building as well.
Yeah. And the ex-Chicago police officer who killed Laquan McDonald, he's set to be released next month after serving less than half of his 81-month sentence. Were you surprised, Rick, to hear that Jason Van Dyke is getting out so soon?
I was surprised only because, you know, we forget just how time passes here. And what a lot of people remember or need to remember is that, you know, he was charged in state court, and so state court is much more lenient on time off of a sentencing. So for him to serve about half of his 81-month sentence is about right. He's due to be released on February 3rd. And, of course, Department of Corrections is not saying where he's being housed, although I believe it's out of state. But, yeah, I think it just shows how quickly time goes by. If he had been charged in a federal charges, those kinds of things, that's normally a 75% of your sentence gets served here. So
right.
I guess we shouldn't really be surprised that he's getting out as soon as he is.
And Aaron, former 22nd Ward Alderman Ricardo Munoz made headlines this week, too. He's hoping to avoid prison time after pleading guilty to wire fraud and money laundering. Are federal prosecutors on board with him avoiding prison?
Not so much. His attorney is trying to make the argument that Munoz shouldn't have to serve prison time and should instead, you know, be able to serve his sentence, you know, doing community service. And his attorney seemed to make the argument that, like, what he did was not so bad compared to other Chicago and Illinois officials, what they have done in the past. So, yeah, what he did was he took money from the Chicago Progressive Reform Caucus and used it for personal expenditures, including a tuition payment, and that's not legal. So yeah, the feds are requesting that he serve like a little over 1 year in prison since he did break the law and he's a public official. But yeah, the Munoz's attorney is arguing that it would be, you know, further burden on the prison system and cost taxpayers. So we'll hear more about that in February during his next hearing.
And Rick, we've got new details in the investigation of Alderman Ed Burke. What did we learn from this 160-page FBI document?
Yeah, this has been a long-awaited document, but this is basically the affidavit that was used that led to the 2018 raid of his aldermanic offices. Here again, how far time passes. We're talking almost, 4 years ago that this investigation and prosecution has been taking place. And what it basically showed is that we knew then Alderman Danny Solis had been taping Burke over these allegations that Burke used his public office to benefit his property tax reduction law firm. But we also learned that the FBI also has video as he allegedly tried to use that office for his tax business. What we're still kind of waiting for, though, is, it just shows the voluminous documentation that the feds have compiled here, and that's part of the reason why we've really yet to go to trial, because of the defense attorney saying that, to comb through all the information that the prosecution's bringing is just taking a tremendous amount of time.
Let's turn now to COVID. Panel, there was a big announcement about Chicago's status regarding the peak of the Omicron surge. I want to hear an update from Chicago's top doc, Allison Arwoody.
I am very, very pleased to say that we have formally passed the Omicron peak here in the city of Chicago. However, we are a long way from being out of the woods, and it's really important over these next few weeks and months that we continue to work hard on getting folks vaccinated, getting folks tested, continuing to wear masks, because there's a long way to come down. However, I'm really pleased to have seen this turnaround.
What more are we hearing, Erin?
So that's good news that we've reached that point in this, but officials are kind of saying they're cautiously optimistic, or that's at least what Governor J.B. Pritzker said, that the state, too, is past the worst of this surge. Numbers are going down in Chicago.
Are people buying that?
I don't know. I mean, personally, and everyone who I know, I think we're still kind of operating in the same sphere that we were a week ago, 2 weeks ago. That also could be because it's winter and it's cold outside, and I'm not running out to, go do things.
Right.
But Allison Arwoody did say that, as numbers continue to go down and if this continues, some restrictions could ease up, including at some point, getting rid of the vaccine requirement indoors, which that was kind of surprising to me. But it was pointed out, you can't operate that way forever. So I'm interested to see at what point these restrictions do ease and, how that affects, mask mandates and everything else. I've just kind of gotten used to wearing a good mask wherever I go. And it's nice now that it's cold outside. It keeps me a little warm, too.
Exactly. Well, with this news about the city passing the Omicron peak, Chicago Public Schools announced that it wanted to shorten the quarantine and isolation period to 5 days from 10. What did CEO Pedro Martinez have to say?
Yeah, so he said this is in line with guidance from the CDC and from the state. So Martinez said this week that the district is, in the process of working on shortening the logistics of shortening that quarantine time, because you can't just, I don't actually know what goes into shortening that time, but it's going to be a process for shortening the required isolation time for students and employees, teachers.
Right.
But I think he said we could expect more on how what those changes would look like next week.
CPS is also revealing that they've doubled the number of students being tested regularly for COVID. So there's another change they've seen since the fallout a few weeks ago. And I know that was one of the major changes that the teachers union was asking for, wasn't it, Erin, for more testing?
Yeah, that was something. So, yeah, when the teachers walked out, they said, they were demanding better safety, protocols and testing. Yeah, that is interesting to see that there is, this is a tangible way, I guess, that this walkout affected change, at least in testing. But yeah, I'm interested to see where we are, I guess, a month from now and how, these the kind of eased quarantine restrictions.
Well, sticking with testing, Erin, there was an alarming COVID story this week. It was first reported by Block Club Chicago that the Minnesota Attorney General is suing a suburban Chicago testing company. What's the Center for COVID Control being accused of exactly?
Yeah, so the Center for COVID Control, they have sites that have kind of popped up throughout the city, sometimes seemingly overnight. And Black Club's reporting has shown that, you know, the testing sites, one, they've shut down after allegedly sending people fake or, you know, incorrect results after they tested at their centers. And, you know, it also found, reporting also found that the owner of this company was, like, bragging over social media about what he could buy with, you know, money from COVID testing. And the stories, you know, they kind of just keep coming, as Black Club reported yesterday that the Center for COVID Control got $124 million in funding from the federal government to do the testing. And, you know, as testing was ramping up, the company couldn't keep up with the demand, and employees ended up leaving tests unrefrigerated and being told to lie to people about their test results. So that's really unfortunate, as people were testing to see their family and friends over the holidays. It's kind of seems like the crux of when all this, you know, happened.
Right. And unknowingly, some of them, you know, passing COVID on to family members, thinking they're negative when, you know, perhaps they were positive, but they're test results were inaccurate. And this isn't the only company that's being accused of this kind of testing scam, is it, Erin? There have been a lot of headlines this week about these phony clinics popping up.
There have, yeah. And I know at least the Tribune had a story yesterday, I think, with tips for finding legitimate sites, because, you know, that's one question I have. Where do I go then? And one of them is, you know, go to state-run or government-run sites first, ask questions about the tests that are being given and the labs that the tests are being sent to. Another tip is to know to be wary of sites that are asking people to pay cash or, you know, credit directly for these tests. So I don't want to say it's like the Wild West, but now that all of these phony testing sites are closed, there are fewer places to go to get tested, and it is.
There sure are.
Yeah, it's kind of stressful.
Switching gears, Rick, a new area code is coming to the south suburbs today. Can you give us the 411 on 464?
Yes, get used to,
had to
4,
do it. Had
6,
to do
4.
It.
Very good. Yeah, that's going to be the overlay area code for the 708, current 708 area, which is in the south suburbs. And, you know, this is this will require everybody will have to dial the 1+ in that area. And it's going to create a bit of havoc for those users. But it's something that we've seen in other parts. And basically, you know, it's partly the explosion of cell phones in our culture in the region. And we've seen these overlays added before in the past. And now people, when they see their cell phone light up with a 464 and go, where the heck is that coming from?
Mm-hmm.
They should be aware it might be one of their relatives calling.
That's right. You know, we'd like to end the recap whenever we can on good news. Area animal shelters, they're getting a boost. That's thanks to actress and comedian Betty White. Paws Chicago, which is the Midwest's largest no-kill shelter, said that they received $100,000 as part of the Betty White Challenge. That was last Saturday on what would have been her 100th birthday weekend. And the Animal Care League in Oak Park, which is where Betty White was born, they also received quite a number of donations. Rick, it's pretty incredible the impact that she continues to have, huh?
Yeah, you know, and this was just a very simple request for a very beloved actress and comedian of just send $5 to your favorite shelter, $5. And the outpouring of support, as you mentioned, you know, here in Chicago and in the suburbs, and this was a national effort. And, I mean, the money was recorded by zoos, recorded by just even, you know, local suburban shelters of various dog breeds. I mean, just a tremendous kind of loving moment in a kind of culture where we all are looking at divisiveness all the time.
That's wonderful. That's Rick Pearson, who's chief political reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and Erin Haggerty, City Hall reporter for the Daily Line. Thank you both for joining us. That's it for the weekly news recap. Even though Chicago is passing its Omicron peak, we still must be vigilant in battling this virus. To get the latest tips on protecting your health, make sure you hit the subscribe button for this podcast. Then take a few seconds to give us a rating and a review. Doing that helps people find us. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. Come back soon.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.